Killers and Mr. Brightside to start the hour, and Blue the Tiger there with Vintage featuring the line "He knows all the words to Mr. Brightside." It's 30 minutes past 8, the Full English Breakfast Show, and now is Mr. Brightside in person. It's Gavin Sharp from Be Very Wellbeing. Hello, Gavin, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Hello. Thank you for the sweeties.
You are welcome. I couldn't get you sherbet dip. I tried everywhere. No sherbet dip.
Didn't like the licorice anyway.
Sarah, I think, had cornered the market in the sherbet dip.
Really?
No, I haven't touched them. It's very sweet of you. Thank you, Gavin.
You've sweet, got some, boom, boom.
You've got
Haribos.
Some fraise, yeah, fraise tagadas.
They're quite nice, actually.
They're very nice.
No, you're confusing sherbet fountains with sherbet dips. Sherbet dips came with the lolly and you had to spoon the sugary stuff into your gob. But the sherbet fountain, you had to suck it through the licorice straw.
Oh, so your dentist must have loved you.
I didn't like the licorice. I used to take it out and just tip the rest down my throat. Anyway, we're not here to talk about sweets. We're here to talk about children and why our childhood matters. Children should be seen and not heard.
Well, that's certainly one way of looking at it. It may not be the healthiest, but definitely one way.
Yeah, there's a vast difference in the way the French and the British bring up their children, isn't there? Have you noticed?
I'll be politically correct, but yes, I have noticed some differences.
Well, so when you see sort of children in English pubs running around and causing havoc, and in France they're perfectly well-mannered and they sit at the table for 3 hours on end and make polite conversation.
But actually, you know what, you joke about the children being seen and not heard, but that for a long time, you know, probably up until about 1950s, 1960s, the prevailing view was don't mollycoddle children. And the best thing you can do is provide food and shelter, but don't make too much of a fuss. And it's only in very recent times that we've started to question that. And we started to look at the role of giving children affection and touch and love rather than that slightly more reserved, stiff upper lip.
I think my mum must have misread the message, because when she said food and shelter, I mean, she used to leave me out on the doorstep in my pram with a banana.
And a sherbet dip?
No, that was before I got to the sherbet dips. But no, it used to be, well, I think it's still, is it still widely held that exposing children to cold boosts their immune systems? I think that's what she did it.
Yeah, there's that. There is a debate that's still ongoing because we don't have any kind of conclusive evidence. We have more. But it's the whole what you do when the baby's crying. And there's a school of thought that says, you know, you leave the kid to cry and that's how they learn to self-regulate. And there's another school of thought, which is you don't let your kid cry and you go and give them attention.
So sharp, you little bleeder, isn't de rigueur these days.
You talking to me or is that the...
You got a guilty complex. We're going to enlarge on this subject a lot more after 9 o'clock, but I believe you have a teaser for us this hour.
I have a teaser. So here's what I'd like people to think about. And it was interesting hearing you and Sarah before the news, because you're absolutely right. Whenever I talk about childhood, everyone's thinking about their childhood. And then if we're parents, we're like, oh, wait a minute. What does that mean for me as a parent? So here's the teaser. So I want you to imagine that you're a child and you fall over and you graze and you cut your knee. You fall over and you're with mum or dad. Let's say it's mum. So three responses. And which is the one that matches your parenting style the most? You fall over and hurt your knee. Does mum panic? And does mum say, this is just dreadful. I've got to get you to the hospital. I don't know what to do. This is awful. This could go septic. This is really problematic.
But for a cut knee.
Well, let's just say mum is panicking. Okay. The second is get up. You're fine. Don't make a fuss. It's just blood. Wipe it off. We'll get to school. You're fine. Now stop making a fuss. Mummy's very busy. And the third is let me have a look at it. Let me kiss it better. I think it's going to be okay. I'm just going to wipe it and you'll be okay. Does it hurt a bit? Okay. Which of those three either represents, I guess, your parenting style, but more crucially, growing up, which was the one that you most can relate to? And then after the, you know, after the 9 o'clock news, we can talk about why I'm asking you to think about that.
Okay. And what other areas are you going to be touching on in the next hour?
So I'd like to talk a little bit about why childhood matters. How is it that this stuff from, depending on our age, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, can it really determine the way we are today, the way we love, who we love, And if we do have mental health problems, depression, anxiety, how much of that really is rooted in those first few years?
Okay, good stuff. Any questions for Gavin? We've got a few lined up already, but there's still time for one or two more. Studio at revereradio.nc. We had one saying, how should I be an ideal parent? And the answer is, don't be like Rob and Sarah.
And now it's time for Woofer of the Week on 106.5 Riviera Radio.
Well, at last I get to speak to Dawn Howard, owing to several gremlins in the system over the last couple of weeks. How are you, Dawn? OK?
I'm OK, thank you. It's really nice to finally talk to you.
Yes, this technology is going beyond me, I must say. I'd rather just sit at home and read the newspaper.
I can imagine.
OK, what have we got this week, please?
Before we start this week, just to say we had lots of interest in Snoopy last week, so fingers crossed that that amounts to something good. Today I've got a real sweetheart of a dog. He is only 16 months old, and that's a great age to adopt, by the way. His name is Pixel, and he is medium-sized and has a shiny black and white coat and a white sock. He's full of energy, of course, at that age, and he loves going for long walks and playing, so active owners are going to love him. He learns quickly, and he's very affectionate. He needs a family with a garden who will meet his needs and continue his training and not leave him for long periods of time. He will suit owners without young children better, as he tends to overguard his food bowl. He does get on with children though, and he gets on with cats and dogs as well, so that's good news. He's vaccinated, chipped and castrated, and now he just needs super new humans to call his own. So if he sounds like the one you've been looking for and you live in the Alpes Maritimes, then please email, this is all one word, Association Poilu. It's spelt Poilus, but it said Poilu, I believe, at gmail.com for more details.
He sounds like a dog after my own heart because I closely guard my food bowl as well. Have to at my place.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I think it's quite typical of a lot of dogs, actually, but they just want to be really careful around small children, of course.
And Pixel, I could play the Pixies, but that doesn't really fit. So would you accept a song about a photograph instead?
Of course.
Well, that's very nice of you.
I'm very obliging like that. You know me.
Thank you, Dawn. Talk to you next week.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
That was Woofer of the Week. For more details about this week's Woofer, go to the 106.5 Riviera Radio page on Facebook or our website at rivieraradio.mc. Woofer of the Week on 106.5 Woofiera Radio.
The Press Review is brought to you by BMW Côte d'Azur.
The Guardian reports the police officer murdered the former Aston Villa striker Dalian Atkinson, first shooting with a taser stun gun for 33 seconds, then kicking him in the head as though striking a football, causing his head to snap back violently, a jury heard on Tuesday. PC Benjamin Monk denies murder and manslaughter following the incident on the 15th of August 2016 in Telford, Shropshire, which began at the home of Atkinson's father.
And in this morning's Figaro, the French government is considering allocating more doses of the COVID vaccine to tourist areas this summer. It's in order to continue the vaccination campaign despite people leaving for holidays. Emmanuel Macron has promised since January that all adults in France will be vaccinated by the end of the summer. This objective will mean a very large organisation for the Ministry of Health. Several scenarios are being considered so that in the event that a person has received their first dose of the vaccine before going on vacation, the government wants to prevent the French from going back and forth to the place where the first injection took place. This is by providing some departments in France with more doses.
As we were just mentioning with Henk, the Financial Times reports that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen conceded on Tuesday that interest rates may have to rise to keep a lid on the burgeoning growth of the US economy, brought on in part by trillions of dollars in government stimulus spending. Ms Yellen said during an economic forum presented by The Atlantic, it may be that interest rates will have to rise somewhat to make sure that our economy doesn't overheat. Even though the additional spending is relatively small relative to the size of the economy, it could cause some very modest increases in interest rates. but she said these are investments our economy needs to be competitive and to be productive. Later in the day, Ms Yellen tempered her comments somewhat on the need for higher rates, saying she respects the Federal Reserve independence and was not trying to influence decision-making there. Yellen chaired the Fed from 2014 to 2018. "It's not something I'm predicting or recommended," Yellen told the Wall Street Journal. "If anybody appreciates the independence of the Fed, I think that person is me. And I note the Fed can be counted on to do whatever is necessary to achieve their dual mandate objectives." The US economy has been on fire recently, says the paper, with first quarter GDP growth at 6.4%, and Goldman Sachs recently said it anticipates the second quarter growing at around 10.5%.
And in this morning's Le Monde, France is expected to use digital health passes. They are to be discussed in French Parliament. It will be linked to the Tous anti-COVID app, as well as the EU-wide digital green certificate, which is currently being developed. The certificate is intended to be a way of proving that a person has had a recent negative COVID test, that they've been vaccinated with one of the EU-approved vaccinations, or that they've recovered from having the illness. French Prime Minister Jean Castex will give more details during a press conference next week.
BBC World Service news coming up, and then Gavin Sharp with a Wellbeing Wednesday.
The Press Review, brought to you by BMW, Nice Premium Motors, Bayonne Avenue Cannes and BMW Store Monaco. Boost your business with the Business Drive BMW range. Find all the BMW Business Drive offers at your car dealer.
Pop quiz time.
It certainly is, and it's loosely along the theme of childhood, just to give you a clue. Question number one. This iconic song about growing up reflects upon a time when the singer bought his first guitar back in the summer of 69.
Bryan Adams.
Correct.
In the summer of 69.
Correct. Question number two. In this classic song about youth that passes by too fast, the singer reflects upon his high school glory days.
Bruce Springsteen.
Well done.
Glory days.
And finally, who doesn't remember this song from the last moments of Grease about those special relationships that we develop in childhood? Oh, come on.
You're the one that I want.
No.
Summer Nights.
At the very, very end when they're all saying goodbye and
they're
at the
remember.
Fairground. And...
Summer Nights, You're the One That I Want, Grease is the words.
No, it's literally the one when the
lightning.
Credits start rolling.
No, I can't
and
remember.
You just, we go together.
Is that what it's called?
Yes.
We go together.
Like ding 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 ding. No?
No.
Do you not remember it?
Well, I only...
cracking tune.
I've only ever seen it once in the cinema.
No!
Yeah.
Oh, you've got to see it again. Your daughter's seen it.
I think so, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I went to see it in the cinema with Alison Ells.
Was that another?
And spent most of the time kissing her, but...
Oh, so that's why you didn't see the end?
I think we'd left by then.
Riviera Radio. Business.
Caught 2 days in a row. Must be a new record. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. You sound a bit down in the mouth, you know, you've been forced
not
back to work.
Down in the mouth. Lovely to be back with you. Happy to guide you through the turmoil of the global economy and financial markets.
Yeah, well, you come back and the markets take a nosedive. You know, what have you got to say for yourself?
It's not really me. It's our old friend, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. You normally do your sound at this point.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Come on. What do you do? I can't remember.
Carry on. Now you're doing a very good job on your own.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen added to investors' fears of rising inflation resulting in an early liftoff in policy by saying rates will have to rise at some point to stop the economy from overheating. It's somewhat of a careless comment, it has to be said. Janet Yellen, former chair of the Federal Reserve, should know, of course, that comments can move markets, and that certainly is the case. Because there's been a code amongst policymakers that the messaging is, yes, the economy is doing well, but the exit from this accommodative policy is still a long way off. And as soon as you open the door a little bit to that, it opens up a whole new avenue of questioning what is the time frame of this, what is the parameters we should be looking at, and markets become a little bit nervous. To be fair to Janet Yellen, I think it was an unintended comment, and she did try to walk it back later in the day, but markets certainly reacting to that, along with some nervousness over the impressive rally that we've seen in technology shares and rising military regulatory tensions between China and Taiwan conspiring to push equity markets lower yesterday. So we saw weakness in the tech heavyweights, Apple, Tesla, Amazon, exacerbating the sell-off. So investors question the prospects of future gains with the robust earnings recovery very much priced in. What does that mean for markets? S&P 500 was down 0.7%. Real weakness today in technology. NASDAQ was down 1.9%. Earlier in the day, the Stock 600 in Europe closed down 1.4%. In saying that, we are looking at a stronger start on the European bourses this morning. Currently calling the FTSE up 39 points. DAX over in Frankfurt up 95 points. CAC 40 in Paris up 17 points.
I thought it was an absolute classic that she waited until May the 4th to speak out.
It's true, it's true.
Interest rates must rise, say I. May the 4th be with you.
I think you're the only one who pushes this line, it has to be said.
Well, you started it.
Come on.
But she's sort of kind of treading on Jerome Powell's toes a little bit, isn't she?
A little bit. You'd normally expect the Treasury Secretary to be talking more about policy, talking about economic policy, talking about fiscal policy, talking a little bit about the state of the economy and leaving the prospects for interest rates to the chairman of the Federal Reserve. You're absolutely right.
Take you back to sort of pre-virus era when we were talking about pharmaceutical giants and this quest for a vaccine. I said, how much are these pharmaceutical companies going to make? And Pfizer is doing very nicely. Thank you very much.
Very nicely. Pfizer lifting its sales forecast for its COVID-19 vaccine to $26 billion for this year. That's a 70% jump from its previous projection, reflecting new contracts with governments around the world. The raised goal assumes, I think, 1.6 billion doses of the vaccine, which was co-developed with BioNTech. The vaccine expected to make up more than a third of Pfizer's full-year sales. Cost and growth profit are split 50-50 between Pfizer and BioNTech. The two drug makers have said they aim to produce 2.5 billion doses during the course of this year, of which 900 million doses have not been included in Pfizer's forecast. If it sells that number, vaccines, their sales could be 50% higher than the projected $26 billion. Pfizer, unlike rivals, I think AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, they said Pfizer that they would expect to profit from it. I think the others have decided to go for a non-profit approach.
Shirley, do you own a Ferrari?
I've never even heard that song before. What is
you
that?
Haven't lived Chris Rea.
Okay, I don't know that. But Ferrari shares down 6.1% yesterday. It's biggest drop in more than 12 months after delaying a long-standing earnings target by a year. The Italian sports car manufacturer has been without a permanent CEO for 5 months. CEO unexpectedly resigned at the end of last year, yet to be replaced. Said its goal of earning 1.8 billion euros by 2022 will now be achieved a year later due to the pandemic. Ferrari shares have underperformed in the early part of this year. That's after leading returns in the Stock 600 Automobile and Parts Index for the past 3 years. Rivals such as Volkswagen Daimler, I suppose, are seen as being able to embrace the enthusiasm for electric vehicles more than Ferrari. Ferrari set to unveil its first electric vehicle model only in 2025. Saying that, first quarter earnings actually quite positive. Earnings rose to 376 million euros. They sold 2,771 cars in the first quarter. That was slightly up on a year ago.
Foreign exchanges, please.
Pound's been looking strong over the course of the past couple of trading sessions. Pound against dollar 139, euro dollar coming in at 120. You need 1 euro 15.5 cents for your British pound this morning.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day, sir.
You too. Speak to you tomorrow. Henk Potts from Barclays.
On FM and DAB Plus across the Côte d'Azur, on your phone and worldwide online. This is Riviera Radio with the latest local news for the south of France.
Sarah Lyson has the top stories across the Riviera.
The number of new daily cases of COVID in France is slowing down, with a week-on-week increase in cases below 3% for a third consecutive day on Tuesday. The average of new infections is now down to 20,866. That's less than half the more than 42,000 seen in mid-April. The number of people in hospital with COVID also fell again after 2 days of increases and was down by 523 to 28,427. The number of people in intensive care units with COVID fell by 126 to 5,504, but remains close to a recent high of over 6,000. France also reported 257 new COVID deaths on Tuesday, including 243 in hospitals, and that's down from 311 on the previous day. The French government is gradually unwinding lockdown and curfew measures, hoping that a stepped-up vaccination drive and continued social distancing will bring the epidemic under control. The government says it's on target to giving 20 million people their first dose of COVID by mid-May, the vaccine rather, by mid-May. As of May the 1st, nearly 15.8 million people had received a first vaccine dose. At the beginning of the week, health officials said that more than 3 million doses would be administered this week. That's compared with 2.7 million last week. Non-EU tourists will be welcomed back to France in June, depending on certain health criteria under plans announced by the EU and France. French President Emmanuel Macron said that from June the 9th, it will be possible for tourists from non-EU countries to come to France for holidays on conditions linked to their proof of health status. At present, tourism between EU countries is allowed subject to tests as well as self-isolation in many cases. Meanwhile, France is expected to use digital health passes linked to the Tous Anti-Covid app and to an EU-wide digital green certificate that is currently being developed. The certificate is intended to be a way of proving that a person has had a recent negative COVID test, has been vaccinated with an EU-approved vaccine, or has recovered from having the illness. French Prime Minister Jean Castex is expected to give more details on the digital health pass next week. In other news, France's National Assembly has approved a wide-ranging climate change bill that will prevent the expansion of airports, see an end to open-air terrace heaters, as well as reduce packaging waste. As France aims to cut greenhouse emissions by 40% by 2030 compared to 1990 levels, environmental activists say it's too slow in achieving this. The legislation, which is to pass to the Senate before a final vote, would ban the use of gas heaters on outdoor terraces of cafes and restaurants from April 2022. Schools will have to offer a menu without meat or fish at least one day a week, and supermarkets will have to reduce wasteful packaging to cut plastics use. The bill also intends to cut domestic flights on routes served by a train ride of under 2.5 hours and introduce a ban from 2030 on the sale of cars emitting more than 95 grams of CO2 per kilometre, as well as landlords being prohibited from renting out poorly insulated properties. In local news, motorists in Cannes and Grasse will soon be charged again for street parking. With the end of the daytime lockdown, Cannes and Grasse will soon see the return of parking meters. In Grasse, the system will be back in operation from Wednesday, May the 19th, and in Cannes from Monday, May the 24th. During recent lockdowns, parking meters had been suspended across the region. The brand Le Fumoir du Poissonnier has recalled its 100-gram packets of smoked tuna sold in Le Grand Frais stores in France due to the potential presence of listeria. In a press release on Tuesday, it was announced that the product with a specific manufacturing code, which is available on the Riviera Radio website, and a use-by date of May the 16th, must not be consumed. Concerned customers can contact 0692 256006 for more information. A group of local historians have discovered that a Belgian farmer perhaps unwittingly moved Belgium's border with France. The man moved 150 kilogram stone to enlarge his land near the Belgian village of Ecquelance. But in doing so, he also modified the 200-year-old international border defined by the 1820 Treaty of Kortrijk. As a result of his actions, the border was moved, enlarging southern Belgium territory. The stone in question, engraved with the date 1819, establishes the border between southern Belgium and northern France. It was created following Napoleon's defeat at the Belgian town of Waterloo in 1815 and before Belgium was formed as a state in 1830. Finally, the Art Curiel, Motorcars here in the Principality has unveiled the first cars registered at its next auction on July the 19th. And amongst them is an Aston Martin DB5 identical to that of James Bond. About 100 cars will be auctioned on July the 19th at the Hotel Hermitage here in Monaco. Cars each more remarkable than the next for the most anticipated sale of the summer.
Riviera Radio, sports news.
Better get your chequebook out
then.
Yes. I want that Aston Martin. I've wanted it for years.
Somebody's had a good year.
Ever since I was a little boy, I wanted that car. Oh, I can do without the ejector seat and stuff, but just get me the car. Formula One, Monaco will open grandstands to the public for the Grand Prix later this month. Monaco authorities say grandstands will be open to up to 40% of capacity for the 3 days of the event on the 20th, 22nd and 23rd of May. Attendance will be limited to a maximum of 7,500 spectators a day, and there will be no restriction on the country of origin for those attending. Spectators will have to take a PCR test for COVID-19 no more than 72 hours before attending the event and take proof of the negative result to the track. Monaco residents and workers attending will not have to provide a PCR test. Gonna have their work cut out, aren't they?
Certainly are.
Checking all those PCR tests. Football, Manchester City are through to their first ever Champions League final. Here are the details from BBC Sports.
BBC Premier League update from the home of Premier League football.
Hello, I'm Al Ross at BBC Sport, and Manchester City have reached the Champions League final for the first time in the club's history. Riyad Mahrez scored both goals on the night in a 2-0 win over an ill-tempered Paris Saint-Germain, securing a 4-1 aggregate win and a place against either Chelsea or Real Madrid in the final. The former City defender Nader Manuaha says it would take a wonderful performance to stop City if they keep playing the way they are.
The standards are so high that they just want to win everything possible. So the aim is to try and, you know, win this game against Chelsea at the weekend to maybe wrap up the league. And then if they do play them in the Champions League final, I think they'll be more than prepared. Obviously, you can't guarantee a result, but based on what I've seen for these last two games, I think you can feel pretty good that they'll be able to put forward a good performance. And it hopefully will make a good game for the neutral.
The other semi-final between Chelsea and Real Madrid is poised at 1-1 ahead of their second leg at Stamford Bridge, but the Spanish club have announced that captain Sergio Ramos is available again after injury. Just 15 days after being sacked by Tottenham, Jose Mourinho's return to football management's been confirmed. He will take charge of Roma from next season, replacing Paulo Fonseca, who will leave at the end of the current campaign. European football writer Nicky Bandini says there's a huge task facing the former Spurs manager to make a Roma side that can challenge for top honours.
I think that's going to be a really fascinating dynamic to see how much Mourinho expects of the ownership in this coming transfer window, whether he's got some agreement with them about the amount of money the club will be spending, the sorts of players they're going to go after, because to me right now, this is not one of the top squads in Italy.
And for more football news from the BBC, go to bbc.com/football.
BBC Premier League update from the home of Premier League football.
He didn't hang about, did he?
No, he certainly didn't.
Wonder how long it will be before he starts wearing a laurel wreath. And come on, you Blues, tonight.
Yes. Ooh. What do you reckon?
I'm nervous.
Are you?
Yeah.
No, don't be.
Well, it's Real Madrid, isn't it?
Yes.
They have made 13 finals before.
Didn't want to point that out, but... Yeah. You never know, anything can happen.
Got to keep the tie at the back, you know, hit him on the break. there was one game in the English Championship last night. Luton and Rotherham drew 0-0. The result means that Rotherham's Championship survival hopes are now out of their hands, and they'll need other results to go their way if they are to stay up. It's going to be a very interesting last day in the English Championship before the playoffs. And in cricket, the Indian Premier League has been suspended after several more players tested positive for coronavirus. In a statement, the IPL said it had unanimously decided to postpone the season after an emergency meeting. Many foreign players have been playing in the IPL, and countries are now working to repatriate their nationals, although the authorities in England say there are no plans as yet to charter a flight to bring players home.
The weather forecast, brought to you by Accelerate Marine.
The coastal area is up to 20 miles offshore the Isle Maritime in the Var. The general situation is a depression 1,005 millibars over the Gulf of Genoa and high pressure 1,020 millibars building over southwestern France. Winds are west-southwesterly, force 6 to 7. The sea is moderate to rough. Visibility is good. Barometric pressure at Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat, 1,016 millibars. And the outlook for Thursday, clear skies, force 6 to 7 westerly winds, moderate to rough seas and good visibility. For North Corsica, winds are southwesterly, force 6 to 7. The sea is moderate to rough. Visibility is good. Barometric pressure at Cap Course, 1,015 millibars. And the outlook for Thursday, clear skies, force 6 to 7. Southwesterly winds, moderate to rough seas and good visibility.
The weather forecast, brought to you by Accelerate Marine. For enhanced, high-performing connectivity on board your yacht, speak to our expert team today about our VSAT and 4G packages. Visit connectmyyacht.com.
Riviera Radio. Weather.
Mainly fine, moderate westerly winds, temperatures 21 to 23 degrees. Overnight lows 14 or 15 degrees with clear skies. Thursday and Friday mainly fine with a brisk westerly wind. Highs of 21 to 25 degrees. 25?
They said, yeah, 26 this weekend, 25? Apparently.
Lice will have a bikini out.
Certainly will. Finally.
Yeah.
Don't snigger when you thought of me wearing a bikini.
I wasn't sniggering, I was tittering.
Well, a study has found, of course, that women can read minds better than men. Who'd have thought it? If you've ever wondered what your partner, friend or family member is thinking, then it's likely you'll be more likely to know if you're a woman, as ladies can mind read better. This is according to new research. Many men often wonder what is a woman thinking or wanting? But it seems as women don't need to worry as much, as according to new research, they can read minds better than their male counterparts.
What's wrong?
Nothing. Researchers say women probably don't know what they want either. Researchers say
nobody knows what they want.
Researchers say humans can mind read and say women are better at it than men. And mind reading is, of course, when a person understands what someone else is thinking or assume it without actually having to ask them. This usually involves picking up on someone's behaviour as well as body language to assess whether someone is not saying what they're really thinking.
I say.
Or you can get it incredibly wrong.
Yes.
Then you feel really stupid.
Guessing the wrong end of the stick. You're up to date. The news is on the website, rivieraradio.mc. Now, it's a Wellbeing Wednesday today with our friend Gavin Sharp from Riviera Wellbeing. And all about childhood today. According to Gavin, our childhood is a big deal. We learn how to love by how we were loved. Our childhood shapes the way our brains develop. In summary, our childhood impacts most areas of our adult lives. So how was your childhood?
Oh, I think you just have to get over it and move on.
Right. Also, parenting. What are your children thinking?
Oh, this is why I'm not going to...
And
I think
what
I
do your children think about you?
Oh, I'm going to go for a very long coffee break, I think.
Any questions for Gavin? Studio@rivieraradio.mc. Studio@rivieraradio.mc. I believe he will be popping in sometime between 8 and 9 to set out what he's going to talk about in more detail after 9 o'clock. Cat Stevens and Where Do the Children Play? Can we have our ball back, please, mister? No, you can't, because last time you broke a pane of my window in my greenhouse. 9:10. Gavin, hello.
Good morning.
Again.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed the last programme about infidelity, because I wanted to find out what Sarah had been up behind my back.
She didn't give much away.
Didn't she?
Oh, no.
She didn't.
That's not what other people thought.
Really? OK, well, I shall have to listen to the podcast, which will be available on our website later, and it's on your website as well.
It is indeed.
Which is?
Which is rivierawellbeing.com.
OK, why are childhood matters? We touched on it in the last hour, and you gave us a teaser. Could you just remind us about that?
I did. I gave you a teaser, and I said, imagine that you are a young child and that you fall over. So you're walking with mum, maybe you're going to school, and you fall over and graze and cut your knee. And I gave you three responses and said, what do you imagine, how would mum have responded? So first response, mum panicked. Mum said, this is terrible, there's blood gushing everywhere, the leg is going to go septic, it's going to have to be amputated, this is just dreadful, I'm so scared, let's get you to hospital. Second response, mum said, get on with it, you're fine, it's just a gash, it's just blood, you're okay, stop making a fuss, I'm busy. And the third response was, let me have a look, let me kiss it better, I think it's okay, when we go home we'll put a plaster on and everything will be okay. And I was curious to know, when we talk about that, which one do you most relate to?
I want a plaster now.
Well, there's always the sport child, so that's the child's response, possibly. But I asked the question because that's a clue to what it's like being a child and how this influences our sense of self and our self-esteem. So, for example, in the first example where mum panics, what does the child learn? And the child learns that actually, I have to caretake mum. I have to look after mum because my needs are not going to be met. And actually in both the examples, and in the second example, the child learned something similar, but there's no point in me even trying to get my needs met because mum is distant. She's distrustful. And in both those examples, that's going to impact my my relationships. So in the first example, there's a very strong probability that my what I learn, if this is consistent over childhood, we're not talking about a one-off incident, but what I'm going to learn is I'm going to be slightly anxious in my relationships. This is the person who kind of wants to merge, who is always worried that their partner's going to end relationships because growing up, there was this just sense of inconsistency. And in the one where the parent just is dismissive and ignores them, then they grow up with a more avoidant style. They're uncomfortable with closeness. They're aloof. They don't trust easily because that was their experience. And the third example, of course, where mum says, let me kiss it better, and they're more secure in their relationships. So I gave that slightly silly example just as a kind of introduction to it matters because it shapes so much of what we learn about ourselves and life.
My answer was verging between 2 and 3, but Sarah was, I bet you were 1, weren't you?
What I would do as a parent, and no, as a parent, I would say, get up, you're fine. And I've done it twice. And I made my son at the age of 2 walk back from the Corsolaire with a broken foot because I said he was absolutely fine. So my parenting style did change after that because it happened on 2 occasions. As a child, my mother would have said, you know, kiss it better. And yeah, but I would have looked for who to blame because I fell over.
Did she make some trifle afterwards?
Yeah, that's probably something to say more about my personality than my parents.
So. Yeah, I've been kind of, you're right, it's just a scratch, get up and then, or if it's a little bit more serious, let me have a look at it, it's okay. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Everything we talk about today is it's relative because there will be times when you're rushing to work and you're just saying, look, get on with it. And we're tired, we haven't slept. So it's not about a one-off incident. It's about that if that style consistently is, every time your child is reaching out to you, more often than not, you're dismissive or you're not paying them attention. Over time, when their brains are most malleable like sponges, they're going to form a view about relationships and life.
I don't remember my mum making a big fuss. I mean, she would put a plaster on it, but my dad, he didn't get involved with that kind of stuff. He was very good at the big outings, like taking, you know, to see battleships and tanks and stuff, but you know, he didn't put plasters on, I don't think. Mm. So, how was your childhood then, anyway?
How was my childhood? My childhood was, I think apart from the time when my father tried to sell me, I was being obnoxious and we were walking down the street and I think I was about 8 years old. And my parents didn't quite know what to do with me. So he started actually shouting out as we're walking down the street, anybody want to buy a boy? Anybody want to buy? And one person did come up to him. We were actually abroad at the time. But apart from that, I think it was all right.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. You were all right, weren't you?
Yeah, I was all right. Yeah. Well, I was a middle child, so I think that.
Ah.
Yeah, middle child.
I was the youngest
syndrome.
One, see, so, yeah. Had an elder brother who tried to run me over on his tricycle once, and I've never forgiven him. But
yeah, it'll do that sort of thing.
Yeah. but you know, as a psychotherapist, I mean, this is the old cliche, isn't it? That to tell me about your childhood. Why is it that psychotherapists want to talk about childhood so much? Do you think?
Well, I think as we're saying, because it shapes our who we are. It shapes our core beliefs, how lovable we believe we are. And I think, you know, when we look at our childhood, we've all got childhood wounds. It's impossible not to have some rejection, some hurt, some pain. And when I talk to clients about childhood, we often talk about trauma with a capital T and trauma with a small t. And trauma with a capital T is we can look back at our childhood and say there was an event. Maybe there was a death. In the family, there could have been abuse. That's trauma with a capital T. But the stuff that we don't think about, I mean, all three of us just said to each other, yeah, my childhood was okay. What we sometimes ignore when we do that is trauma with a small t, which are the psychological and emotional injuries. So really practical and common example is maybe one of my parents was a workaholic. So they weren't around that much. So when we look back at our childhood, we think, yeah, nothing bad happened. And it's not that something there was something bad happened, but sometimes there's an absence of something good. So my dad in that example might have been physically present, or not in that case a lot of the time if he was a workaholic, but certainly sometimes we have parents who are physically present and emotionally absent. And in our first kind of 7-8 years, we form this template about the world, about how we're going to, for the rest of our lives, how we're going to see the world. And those first few years have a massive impact on that.
Because a lot of people sort of say, oh, well, it's all in the past now. I don't live like that. I can't really remember my childhood. But it's always something in the back of your mind locked away somewhere.
Absolutely. So the, you know, father of psychology, Freud, who, you know, got lots of stuff wrong. But, you know, what we know is true is the stuff that's locked away in the mind, which is in the unconscious. And memory is really interesting because when we talk about memory, we talk about explicit memory and implicit memory. So the explicit is, I remember what I had for breakfast this morning. Usually. The implicit memory is that all of our memories are stored in our body. So even if I don't consciously have access to them, my body remembers them.
Isn't it dangerous on how you remember them? Can that not be distorted sometimes? And when do you stop remembering them? When do you, for example, say, OK, that happened at that time, I remember it like this, it might not have happened in that way, but when do you actually, because we're taught maybe to live in the present mm-hmm. and now, when do you actually let the past go?
It's a great question. I think to the first part, we do sometimes misremember very early memories because we've been told the story by mum and dad of that time when you were three and you fell over in the park, and then we think we remember it. And so we can't know the very early memories. We probably don't have the explicit memory. We probably don't have access to. To your point, at what point do you let them go? I think if there is stuff that is troubling us, I think when we've processed the emotions around it, because sometimes we come to therapy and we've got unprocessed trauma. And when we begin to make sense of it, when we begin to allow ourselves to feel the pain that we've never allowed ourselves to feel, or the anger or the grief, then actually we're able to let go of them. Does that make sense?
Yes, no, yeah. It certainly does. I mean, I think it also the parent side, you know, you don't get any thanks as a parent, do you?
No.
Little snippets, maybe later on, fingers crossed.
I can remember, you know, I think I treated my parents pretty badly for a few years when I was a teenager, and I was forever grateful to them for putting up with me for so long, and you know, I tried to make it up to them in later life, I think.
And teens do, as we know. Part of being a teenager is we're trying to establish our identity, and actually it's more damaging if the teenager, you know, when teenagers are so compliant and when someone says, oh, my kids, they're so good, I've had no problems with them. On the one hand, I take that at face value. That may be true. And on another level, I get suspicious. And my therapist in me thinks, but why not? Because we all have a need to individuate. And that's what we do in our teens. We go out, we experiment. Mum and dad show us boundaries about what's okay and not okay. We push against those boundaries. And then we gradually come back to the fold. So that, to me, feels like healthy development.
Of course, I was just thinking about, you know, memories, and anyone listening to this in 100 years' time wouldn't know what you're going on about, because by that time, Elon Musk will have us all hooked up to a hard disk, and every single memory you have from the day you're born will be logged and given a file name, and you'll be able to call it up at random.
Yeah, what was in that vaccine?
Gavin Sharp from Riviera Wellbeing is here. Every first Wednesday of the month, it's Wellbeing Wednesday. We do have some of your questions coming up. Interested to know how your childhood might affect your romantic relationships, past, present or future. Is this the equivalent of marrying your mother?
Well, I think we do often. There is a theory around that we do marry a kind of... We marry our parents. We marry a mixture of our parents for unconscious reasons because it's familiar. Now, I've forgotten. What was the first part of the question?
How it affects your romantic relationships, past, present, future.
So I think if you think about my example of, you know, the child who fell over, eventually I'm going to form a view about, can I trust people? And if I grew up and my parents were quite they weren't there for me, or there was an abandonment, then, and we all have a primal fear of abandonment, but let's say that, you know, there was an abandonment when I was 6-7 years old, it's impossible for that not to have impacted me. And as kids, we're all egocentric. So all this stuff that happens in our childhood, we don't have the, you know, the part of our brain where we do all the rational thinking, the prefrontal cortex, it's not online yet. So as an adult, I can make sense of, you know what, mum and dad weren't very happy and dad left mum and this is what happened. Or dad worked really hard because we didn't have much money. Kids are egocentric. So all this stuff that happens to us growing up, we assume it must be something wrong with me, must be my fault. So I'm going to take that into my love relationships. If I've learned that you can't rely on adults, you can't be vulnerable because being vulnerable means you might be hurt, then that's going to impact me in my love relationship. So absolutely there's a connection.
So what about couples who, you know, where the man compares his partner to his mother and the woman might compare him with her father?
I think it happens a lot. And, I run couples intensive sometimes. And one of the exercises I'll do with a couple is they'll say, oh, no, he doesn't remind me. He doesn't remind me at all of my mum or dad. Or so sometimes it's the opposite. They don't see that. And I will do an exercise with them. And I pretty much guarantee that within an hour, they will both have identified some of the strongest traits of their parents are in their partner. And actually, I often see that marriage is two people with wounds who are coming together, and I want the other person to heal my childhood wounds. That's the implicit contract of a marriage. So I'm going into my relationship because I want to be saved. I want someone to help me process my wounds. And what makes it really problematic is we don't talk about that when we're dating, and I'm busy wanting to get my needs met, but guess what my partner thinks? Oh, I'm hoping that they're going to make all my childhood wounds better. So relationships are complicated, but they're definitely connected to the past.
We do welcome your questions. You don't have to use your real name if you don't feel like it, so that's perfectly fine. Let's have one now from Mark. Gavin, we're expecting our first baby imminently. Congratulations. What does Gavin think are the essential ingredients to be the perfect parent? Please answer before my wife gives birth.
Well, I would also, first thing I would say is there's no such thing as the perfect parent. We can't be. And actually, when we set ourselves up to be the perfect parents, often what we're doing is we're requiring our kids to be perfect because we're requiring them to, rather than being satisfied that they got 3 A grades, we want 3 A star grades because it's a reflection on us. But to the question about what you can do, I think to be emotionally available for your kids and to, we know that kids need to be touched. We know they need to be nurtured, mirrored, validated. So one of the questions I'll often say when people come to therapy is, how did you know you were loved? And it's a really interesting question.
Be kind but firm.
Yeah.
Are you kind but firm, Sarah?
I'm accused of being strict.
Are you?
Well, I think my children went from the needy phase, which I loved, to then turning into pain in the neck when they were teenagers. And
you can be a little bit strict.
When my son did this is a few years back, when he said, I don't like you, I answered, you're not supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not really supposed to, are you? Like your parents at that age.
So I said, I don't like you either.
But then it's a question of when I'm saying, I'm not pushy, but there are just some things that I think are just basic, you know.
Yeah.
Writing thank you letters, saying, can I leave the table?
Tidying your room.
You're not going
to the... leaving cups and plates lying around, turning off the lights in the bathroom, etc.
Yeah, et not cetera. Going to your bedroom with that bag of Haribo.
Yeah. Yeah, so these are, these are... parental boundaries. And I will tell you that what is just as damaging is an absence of boundaries. So I am working with a client at the moment, and growing up, it was so laissez-faire. So when he came in and we were talking about his childhood, he was saying his childhood was great because I pretty much got to do with what I wanted. I could come home when I wanted got thrown out of school, and it was kind of okay, and I had to go back. But broadly speaking, it was very laissez-faire. And actually, we don't want that as kids. We need to be seen, and we need to have those boundaries to push up against. So that laissez-faire is just as damaging, because really what I'm learning is I don't matter. You don't see me, and that's damaging.
As I was brought up in the 1960s, and I think parenting has changed a lot since that generation of parents, because my mum and dad's idea of a good time was Frank Sinatra and gin tonic, you know, but it's all changed since then. Any parent born in the 60s is now parenting children now and onwards. I mean, it's become very, very different, hasn't it?
Absolutely. So the behaviourist movement up to that point was very much, you know, we were saying this earlier on, was very much about don't mollycoddle your kids, don't make a fuss of your kids. And it was only around kind of the 1950s that there were some very eminent psychologists in the UK, people like John Bowlby, for example, who established the attachment theory. And he studied World War II orphans. And what he couldn't work out at the time was these were kids who were clothed, they were fed, they had a roof over their head, and yet they grew up with so many problems around depression and anxiety. And now we look back and it's kind of a you know, the moment, but he couldn't understand why these kids didn't flourish. And we know now that because they didn't receive love. You know, we are hardwired to connect. We need touch, we need love. And so that thinking from the era when, you know, you're talking about, that has caused a lot of damage to our mental health.
And the whole thing changed really with the sort of Beatles, didn't it? I mean, once the cultural revolution came along in the early 1960s, I mean, people just let it all hang out, man.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would attribute the Beatles to being the preeminent sort of therapist of the era. But
you know what I'm saying, though.
But how does that, that's just that fine line, as you say, between, OK, being a strict parent or that friend. I mean, I remember at school I had a best friend, and she was like, I'm best friends with my mum, and she loved it at the time. And then later on in life, when I meet up with her now, she talks about it, and she says in a way she regrets it, because it was that, it wasn't supposed to be that role. So it's that difficult line, isn't it, between showing the love and the emotion and being emotionally available, but also being firm enough to create that you're not the best friend, but you are the person that is nurturing and bringing up a child.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's cute that the kid feels on one level that mum is my best friend. But I agree with you completely. You know, mum is not supposed to be your best friend. You know, mum is there to give you love and discipline. And so, that example. And it's very interesting that years later, she's looking back and saying, actually, there was something that wasn't right about that. Because when we're made as kids, when we're made into adults too soon, what we're also doing is we lose part of our childhood.
Mm.
And actually, kids should be kids and not mum and dad's best friend.
That was what I was driving at, because I mean, in the mid to late 1960s, there was a lot of, they're not children, they're young people, and they all have rights, and you come in here and try some of this, you know. And
that's
probably a big mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I just wanted to talk about before, we're talking about kind of how this sort of modern psychology and this parenting view has got formed. In the 1950s, there was this experiment by a guy called Harry Harlow, and he did experiments with monkeys, with rhesus monkeys. And I don't know about the ethics, because I'm not sure you'd get away with it today, but he took these monkeys and he separated them from birth from their mothers. And then what he did is he created two surrogate mothers made out of wire. One was made out of wire and one was made out of soft cloth. And the wire one dispensed the food and the soft cloth one did nothing. And what he wanted to do is see that, are we driven to our parents because they provide us with food or because of nurture? And what the monkeys did is that when they were hungry, they briefly went to the mother. It was like a wire hanger. They went to the wire hanger that dispensed food, and they spent the rest of their day cuddling the wire hanger that had a soft terry cloth around it. No food. I mean, he did lots of weird things, like he would scare the monkeys and see whether they ran to the wired mother that had the food or the one with the cloth. And always they ran to the one with the cloth, because they were seeking touch. And that's what we're biologically hardwired from the moment we're born. We need to connect.
Wellbeing Wednesday with Gavin Sharp from Riviera Wellbeing. We've got lots of questions to get through. I think we better make a start with them, otherwise we won't fit them all in. First of all, Mel says, my father was an alcoholic and to this day I won't touch alcohol, so the stuff that happens in childhood is not always a bad thing, is it? Or am I missing something?
Well, I think something good can come out of it. So in that instance, as you're saying that, Mel is saying that, so I don't touch alcohol because I presumably saw the effect it had on my father. I think how I respond to that is, but it must have had an effect on you. And as an adult, you're taking something good from it. But I will tell you, when we grow up with an alcoholic parent or parents, it's very often is traumatic for a child, because at that moment we don't really know what's happening, and that's where the child assumes there must be something wrong with me, otherwise dad wouldn't be angry. Or sometimes children of alcoholics become really hypervigilant to other people's emotions. So sometimes a client will say to me, I never knew what dad I'd get when he came through the door, so I would wait, I would look to the expression on his face. And then I knew whether I had to go to my room and be quiet or whether I could actually hug him. So, and then they take that to adulthood, become really hypervigilant, reading other people, because the brain almost gets just kind of stuck in this sort of fight or flight sort of trauma response. So it's good that then as an adult, Mel's taken something positive. But I'm always curious about what it was like living in that environment.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's not quite often not the substance abuse itself, it's just the emotional impact of it.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, there's a trauma therapist called Gabor Maté, and he does a lot of great work talking about trauma and addiction. And he has a phrase that says that trauma is not something that happens to us, but it's how we respond to it. So two different people can experience the same event. One can be traumatized by it, and the other isn't. So yes, it depends on what other support. I mean, let's take Mel as an example. Maybe Mel had other great support network, maybe grandparents, maybe school. So there may have been lots of other positive influences that actually enabled them to structure it and not have it become traumatic.
Of course, I mean, fear plays a big role in this as well, because quite often alcoholism in particular can lead to mental and physical abuse of one or both partners. And obviously that definitely rubs off on the child. If, you know, mum and dad are slanging it out and beating seven bells out of each other every night, then you're sort of just cowering in your room hiding, aren't you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
On to Moira, who says, my husband and I are thinking of separating, but I'm inclined to stay together for the sake of the children. I wish my parents had done so. I remember how hurtful it was, their divorce. He wants to separate. What would work best for the children? This is anonymous, so that's why I'm using an assumed name, she says.
Without knowing more about the situation, it's really hard to give an effective answer, but I'll give you my gut response, which is that using your example that you just said, if a child is growing up in an environment where it's really stressful, they're living in fear, then that amount of disruption is going to cause that child to quite possibly grow up fearful of relationships and intimacy, with anxiety, depression. And so in situations like that, if the home environment is really toxic, then quite possibly a separation will be better for the child, because the child will have some loss to process, and it will be difficult. But if living with one happy parent rather than two unhappy parents could well be a better outcome for the child. And sometimes I see couples and they'll be arguing a lot. They come for couples therapy and they say, but our child doesn't know, or children don't know anything about our problems. And I will say, yes, they do. Even if you think you've had your argument behind closed doors on where little Johnny is out of the house, kids pick up on everything. They pick up on the energy. They pick up on all of the emotions. So, so my response to that is, it really depends what kind of environment staying together will create for the child.
Right, Kay would like to know. My father died when I was 11 and I have two younger sisters and I became the man of the house and my mother's confidant. We never really discussed his death, but I think we dealt with it in the best way we could. I saw your post on social media about growing up and feeling empty and never fulfilled, and something resonated. Obviously, my father's death was life-changing, but do you think there's really a connection to how I feel today, nearly 27 years later?
Yes, I think there inevitably will be. There were two things that really just stood out in that. One is I was made the man of the house. And this was almost, you know, the discussion that Sarah and I were having before the news about making someone, you know, a parent's best friend. This is very common, where suddenly someone is, whatever age they are, 11, 12 years, you're now the man of the house. So what you're telling that child is your childhood is now gone. So as an adult, this person has to process the loss of their childhood, because actually they're repressing their needs in order to look after mum. My job is to look after mum. So my fear, my anxiety, my joy has to be parked. And very often, and I am generalizing, that's the person that grows up with an underlying anger that they never can quite put their finger on, because there's an injustice to being robbed of our childhood, of being made mum and dad's carer. And the other thing in that to me that was really interesting and sadly very common was you said we never discussed it. And again, I have a client who a parent died and they went to school the next day and it was never discussed again. And the parent's view was that little Johnny's doing really well, really proud of him. And actually, to me, that just is so tragic and so sad, because what has little Johnny done with his grief? So, yes, I think whatever it was 27 years later, it could, I can't know for sure, but it could well have a profound impact.
But in many cases, I mean, you hear this on sort of radio phone-ins quite a lot, you know, problems which have been buried in the past can be resolved by talking when the child has become an adult and just bringing the subject up with mum or dad and saying, you know, this is how I feel about what happened then. And then they talk it out and everything's good afterwards.
Absolutely. So if there's an opportunity to do that and you can talk it out, but I've still taken a whole view from the age of 11. I've still lost that childhood. I'm still going to have anger. I'm still going to have what if I'd had the chance to live my childhood. So, of course, those repressed emotions can be processed, but that's a lot of stuff that's been shoved down into my body for many, many years.
But you're bringing it back to kind of little Gavin now, aren't you? I mean, the first, very first topic we had about, you know, why does this voice inside my head keep telling me that I'm no good and, you know, it could have been a lot better and I've lost all that?
Yeah, absolutely. And because we look back on our childhood and, you know, we only have one childhood, so I can't know what it was, what would have been different. But I look back and I think, well, it wasn't that bad. You know, mum, we carried on. It was okay. We had food on the table. We went on a holiday once a year. It wasn't so bad. But what I've probably done is I've split off or I've compartmentalized all my grief and pain, because actually 11 years old and losing a parent, it's pretty bad.
Christine says you sound great, Gavin.
Oh, thank you. Was that from my mother or that's...
No, just generally.
Oh, okay.
And she also
good.
Says, Sarah, I'm surprised you wouldn't have said kiss it better.
Well, no, I do now. It's just
it's a bit late now. Well, do you think your son still wants you to kiss it better?
No, it was just learning stages, the process of learning how to be a parent.
Oh, look, you've broken your foot. Let me kiss it better. Kristen says, I'm the fourth of six. I know I was one of the lucky ones and had a really lovely mum who sadly died at the age of 69. Once we'd all left home, my mum adopted in all 60 babies, till they were normally 3 months, as in those days, illegitimate babies. My dad was absent, always working on motorcycle racing bikes, but on Sundays when we'd go out for the day, it was a treat. Listening to this, I was definitely a lucky one, I've always thought.
Yeah, and so again, it's how we experience our childhood. And, you know, always when I'm talking about childhood and with clients, none of this is ever about blaming the parents, because if we're lucky enough, we had a parent or two parents who loved us and who did their best. And as we said before, it can't be perfect. So there would be stuff that they got wrong. And when we talk about parents, when someone comes to therapy, it is sometimes quite nuanced. It's now as an adult reflecting on, okay, I see that this happened. What did I learn from that as a child? And what now as an adult do I understand to be different? So so there's all, not always, there is very often a lot of richness and goodness that we can take from our childhoods too.
Going to have to rush through these because there's still got a lot to go. Milosh says, I grew up in a lovely home where my parents provided us with unconditional love and support. As the youngest in the family, I was only 8 when war broke out in Yugoslavia and my parents struggled to even provide food. At this stage, I still wanted to have the latest and most expensive outfit as a schoolboy. I now know how much they've struggled, but they will still do their best to provide my greedy needs, but do not to my older brother and sister, who are more understanding but not that much older than me. I wonder, has their approach had their approach been different? Would it shape me differently too?
Of course, had their approach been different, it would have shaped you differently. What I took from that is, again, what stood out for me is, I wonder what it's like being a young boy in war-torn Yugoslavia. And how much were mum and dad able to be emotionally present to create an environment of safety? How much were they able to still pay attention to my needs? And if they were struggling to put food on the table, that's a classic example of mum and dad did their best. It's not their fault. But I, Milosh, I still might have missed out on something. I might have missed out on being able to play, mum and dad being emotionally present for me.
This one is anonymous, and we've heard a lot about the increase in domestic violence because of lockdown and all sorts of other things at the moment. I was beaten by my father growing up. I'm petrified I'll eventually become an angry parent and do the same. My toddler is 2 years old. Perhaps Gavin could say if I'm right in being worried.
Of course, you're right to be worried about it. I'm hopeful, actually, the fact that you're writing in and this is crossing your mind suggests to me that there is less chance, because you're already asking the question, I don't want to be an angry parent. Obviously, if there are anger issues that you have, important to seek help so that you don't act it out. But I take some comfort from the fact that this is someone saying, I don't want to be like my father.
M says, I had a daughter who was a tough child from day one. Didn't sleep until over 4 years old and created mayhem wherever she went. I set some very solid boundaries, but what I did do was allow her to consider her actions, consider the repercussions, and then do it anyway. She fell on her face more times I dare to remember, but she was always heard, always had a chance to discuss, usually at high volume on her part, and always gathered up and allowed a debrief. She loathed me. She hissed and spat at me and swore that I wasn't her mother. And now she's 25 years old, chief stewardess on a vessel. She allows each individual to be just that and finds their best methods by allowing them to make their own way. She applies her psychological knowledge to all her work and is very well liked by her team and crew. I'm on her phone as cool mum, and she considers me now her best friend, because I will never be anything other than honest and give only my opinion, but ask for hers as well. She still says, you are not like any other mum. I'm so glad you're mine. That's a nice happy story.
It is a happy story. I love the fact that there was a debrief afterwards, because kids, we want to make sense of what just happened. It's wonderful to hear stories like that.
And we round off with one anonymous one again. I've been seeing Gavin for about a year. I just wanted to say that by looking at my childhood, I was able to find the answers, quite shockingly, to several disruptive behaviours that I have today. It's not an easy process at all, and I resisted looking into the impact of my emotionally absent parents, for example, but it is worth it.
That's I don't know who it's from, but absolutely. So emotionally absent parents. So we go back to that. When we talk about childhood, often someone will come in, and this is so common, in their first session, they'll say, I had the perfect childhood. And then they'll say something afterwards like, I was beaten when I was 6 for a few years, but actually it wasn't that bad. And when I say, but why did you say earlier on it wasn't that bad? Because that's pretty bad to me. And what they'll usually say is that, well, I didn't know any different, and little Johnny down the road was beaten more than me. And that, you know, goes almost back to my discussion earlier with Sarah about when you let it go. When something like that happens, it's about processing the anger and the pain from the early stuff. But we bury it. We pretend it's not there. We've got nothing else to compare it to. We minimize it. And those are all things that when we come to therapy, we've got a chance to explore.
Well, thank you very much for all the questions. This always gets a really good response, Wellbeing Wednesday. Sarah?
Yes, just Annette, a very quick last question. What does it mean if you can't remember your childhood?
I think it depends whether you don't remember all of it. I think it's very common to not remember chunks. And as we were saying before, if I remember loads very clearly from less than the age of five, then I might be misremembering. And it's also possible that I'm not remembering it because I blocked out pain. And I've blocked out the stuff that I don't really want to remember. And if that's not causing you any problems in your adult life, that's fine. And if you are suffering from anxiety or depression or mental health problems, then there could be something in it.
Well, I was a quite rebellious teenager, as I think I've mentioned already. But now my younger daughter is getting to that age, and I can see a lot of elements in my character at that time that are coming out in hers. And on the one hand, I don't want to be like my parents because I remember how resentful I felt at the time. But on the second hand, you have got to set boundaries. And now I understand where they were coming from.
Absolutely. So I think there's the dichotomy of being a parent. And then we hear ourselves saying something, when, oh, my God, I just became my father. But you can also ask yourself, what might have made a difference? What would you like to have heard from your parents? And so, but as we said before, teenagers are supposed to rebel. They will test the limits. And it's important that they have limits. And I like, you know, the person who wrote in about afterwards, have a debrief. So none of this is easy, and I don't want to imply that parenting is easy or that any of us are going to get it right all the time, because it's not possible.
But it's very, very difficult to get through to a lot of teenagers. And you say something which you think is sort of being fairly laid back and making a compromise, and you just get either a stony silence or a no in reply. So, I mean, how do you deal with it?
See the frustration. Should we talk off air?
If you want.
No, but I think it's, you want them to try and understand the boundary. And ultimately, it's your house, it's your rules, they're your boundaries. And I think there's that balance between, again, as Sarah was saying before, being strict, but not so rigid or authoritarian that you're squashing them. And it's a balance. But their parents are supposed to get some stuff wrong. Therapist called Donald Winnicott wrote in the, I think it was the 1950s or 60s, about such a thing as good enough parenting. There is a minimal level of love and attention. And with that minimum level of love and attention, our kids are going to work out just fine. And kids learn through rupture and repair. They learn that sometimes things go wrong and then they go right. But we're never going to get it all right all of the time.
My house, my rules. I can't believe I said that the other day.
You said it to me when I came in the studio. You said, Gavin, it's my studio, my rules.
I didn't
and
say
I felt
he
so
says it to everyone. Believe you me.
Oh, you're making it up now. Right, conclusions, Gavin. It's been fascinating as usual this morning.
Yeah, thank you. Look, I, what I will say is, there's anything that I've discussed in this last hour that has triggered you or touched you, then either do some research, drop me an email, gavin@rivierawellbeing.com. And sometimes these things will stir stuff up that we've buried. And if we've buried it, we've buried it for a reason. So be gentle and have self-compassion.
Our next Wellbeing Wednesday will be on the first Wednesday of June. And what is the subject?
I thought we would talk about addiction.
Do we have to?
Oh, crikey.
Look at the fear on Sarah and Rob's faces. Yeah, let's talk about, you know, addiction, and let's talk about what it is. Is it, you know, is it drink? Is it gambling? Is it sex? Is it, can we be love addicted? Where does that come from? What do we do with it? So it's obviously a topic that I see a lot of in the therapy room, and there's a lot of misconceptions about what an addiction is.
And sugar.
I don't have a drink problem.
Said the man who brought a big pile of sweets into the studio with him this morning.
Yeah. And ate some of them before the show.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with drink. What time do the pubs open? Gavin, thank you very much. It's great to see you. And we'll talk again next month.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah, Rob, Riviera Radio. So appreciate the chance to bring mental health to our community.
And there will be a podcast available on our website, rivieraradio.mc, and also on Gavin's as well, which is rivierawellbeing.com.